Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order March 6, 2014. Senator Hayden, Senate File 704. As you can see, we have a lot of interest in what the committee is doing here today. I don't know if it's just for your bill, Senator Hayden.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's a short bill, but I'm glad that so many people are interested in making sure our children are safe.
Good. Well, as I've said before, short session, short deadlines, lots to get done. So we're going to try to stay focused on the tasks at hand and ask you to go ahead and tell us what you're doing here.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we'll be as expeditious as we can. We have Senate File 704. And, Mr. Chair, we do have the A2 amendment that deletes a good portion of the bill. I have Mr. Gearman from Safe Passages for Children of Minnesota that can explain the amendment and then the rest of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Hayden, is this the first stop for this bill? Or is this a re-referral?
Yes, sir.
This year.
This year.
Okay. But in the process, it came from another committee.
Okay, yes,
so it's not an author's amendment. Mr. Gearman, go ahead and describe to us what the amendment is about.
I'm Rich Gearman. I'm the Executive Director of Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota. This bill has two provisions. One is to that the Department of Human Services guidelines for what is child abuse and neglect in Minnesota would become mandatory for counties. And the other is that counties would be required to keep enough information on reports of maltreatment that they screen out, meaning they don't respond to, so that they can identify multiple reports. So I can very briefly say what the reasons are for the bill in the background. I've got it. I think we can do this in 2 minutes.
Can you explain the amendment?
The amendment essentially.
Why don't you pull the mic toward you also so we can all hear.
Yes. The amendment to the bill deletes a long passage that had a work group in it, which would get together and kind of work through many of the issues. And instead it substitutes provisions that counties have to keep enough information on repeat reports of abuse and neglect so you can see when children are reported multiple times. So it's a much shorter bill with just those two provisions. Follow the guidelines. It becomes mandatory for counties and keep enough information to identify when kids are reported multiple times.
Are the counties okay with that?
The counties, yes. The county, Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators represents the counties on this, and they are okay with the bill. We made a number of changes since last year, and that's part of the reason for these revisions. And we've talked with the Department of Human Services. I believe they're all right with it as well. So we have worked this through, I think, to where everybody's okay with it.
Okay. Did you want to give us 2 minutes on the whole bill itself?
Yes. And basically, the legislative auditor 2 years ago did a report which showed that while counties believe that they are following the Department of Human Services guidelines for, if I can put it this way, what counts as abuse and neglect, in fact, the standards vary widely across the state. So part of this is just to get some consistent set of standards. Many of the practices are way outside the bounds of what is accepted nationally as good practice. So this will, we hope, start a conversation to really work those issues through.
We should be focusing on.
And then the other issue is... The other issue is that we are hearing from guardians, from various mandated reporters. The kids are reported many, many times before the county responds. There was a chart that I sent. I don't know if it got in your packet, but it shows that Minnesota only responds to 28% of calls of child abuse compared to 62% nationally. So we respond. That adds up to about 17,000, 18,000 kids a year that are reported that a typical state would probably take action on, and Minnesota does not. So this bill will basically give some transparency to that to be able to see how many times a county has got a report on the child one time, two times, three times, four times, five, et cetera. And we've heard it's not uncommon for kids to report it 5 or 10 times. We've heard 17, 18 times, 25 I saw once. So this basically gives us enough information to start some transparency and accountability. It's the same information the counties have been supposed to be putting into the system since 1999. But what the county attorney and the legislative auditor found was that they are, some put it in, some don't, some put it in sometimes, some don't, some put in this information. So we're trying to get a standard set of information to be able to identify repeat reports.
Mr. Gearman, who maintains the state social services information system?
Department of Human Services.
And what How is that data protected?
Well, this data, I guess I'm not an expert on that, except this is the data on screening. So it's not at the level where it would be put into a database for job searches or anything like that. It's that's like three or four steps down the road after there's a substantiated finding of child abuse, a substantiated case. So this is just the internal workings of the counties and the department. So the only people who would see this basically would be the screeners.
This is Chapter 13, government data.
And I did want to make sure that I leave enough time. We have a second testifier who can give you some practical examples, real-life examples. We've got...
I'm not sure.
Well,
Mr. Chair, I mean, if that would be helpful, we'd like to do it. But if it's clear about the bill, we don't have to have our second testifier, with all due respect to...
Senator Hayden, the reason this is before us today is because of the amendment that would get into data practices, Chapter 13, protected data. So I think that's what we'll try to focus on, is just the contents of that amendment. Members, the amendment is in your packet. It's the A2 amendment. Make sure we're on the same page. Is that what you have
as
the amendment as well, Senator?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So maybe I'm going to ask counsel to give us just a minute on exactly how this data is going to fit into Chapter 13 and what the protections are that go to the data.
Mr. Chairman, members.
Ms.
This is really more of a data retention piece than a classification piece, because the data are private right now under the law. But if you look at the existing law and the amendment, basically there are kind of retention schedules here for how long that reports have to be maintained. And this addresses an area that really isn't clear under the current law. I think this is cases where they're getting reports where it's not enough perhaps to even trigger an initial assessment or investigation, because what the person is reporting might not actually constitute maltreatment, is my understanding, but they still might have a pattern of reports involving the same person. So I think the idea here is to provide for retention of these records for a period of 365 days so that they can sort of have a handle on cases where there are repeat reports and perhaps more of an investigation should be done. I may be putting words into the mouths of the
No, I think
the
only
author,
difference is there's a disagreement about whether they actually do rise to the level of abuse and neglect and are being screened out anyway. So this would help to sort that out.
Do any members of the committee have any questions about the amendment or the overall bill, so that you're comfortable with it, but the amendment in particular? I don't see any committee members jumping to ask any questions. So anything further you'd like to say before we act on the amendment, Senator Hayden?
No, sir, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Hall, would you move the A2 amendment?
I do move the A2 amendment on the Senate File 704.
Senator Hall moves adoption of the A2 amendment. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any further testimony or questions or comments relating to the bill itself? We do have some testimony from Mr. Kingery would like to add something. So Senator Hayden, if one of your testifiers could vacate a chair, Mr. Kingery can come forward.
Okay.
Mr. Kingery, did you want to say anything?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Kingery, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association.
Could you also pull the mic forward, please, John?
And I apologize for coming in so late. I was kind of busy working on tomorrow's agenda, which delayed me getting here today. I did briefly have a discussion with Senator Hayden last year on this bill, and with the proponents earlier this week. Was it last week? And we are meeting with them on Friday, our CHIPS subcommittee. We are very supportive of Section 2. We like the idea of a work group. We do have some concerns over Section 1, that it could lead to a top-down system, and that was one of the concerns that we have. But again, we're going to be meeting with the proponents this Friday and obviously working with Senator Hayden to see if we can't resolve any concerns that we have. And I just wanted to say that for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Kingery, maybe you missed the part. The amendment deletes the work group.
I know
and,
that.
And in its place has some other information.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, I am aware of that. And that was the thing we liked the most, quite frankly. And so I'm here to say that we support what was taken out. But, no, I understand. And Rich did share that was that amendment with us earlier this week.
Okay. So you're raising no objections to the amendment or the information within the jurisdiction of this committee?
Right. Other than our regret that it's removing the working group and then concerns over Section 1, which is outside the jurisdiction of this committee.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cameron.
Thank you.
Anyone else wish to be heard on this bill? All right. We've got a quiet room. So, Senator Hall, would you like to move the bill?
Sure.
Senator
I move Senate File 704 as amended.
Senator Hall moves that Senate File 704 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Do we have the amendment yet on Senator Marty's bill? We were waiting for one to arrive. Not yet. Okay, so we're going to skip item number 2 on the agenda for now. We'll come back to it. After we receive the amendment. Senator Goodwin, Senate File 2277, are you ready to proceed? Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. If you recall, last year we passed some changes to the Safe at Home statute. The Safe at Home program is a program that's run by the Secretary of State's office, and it's a protective program for people that are stalked or abused or in other ways fear somebody or some people and end up getting an unknown address, unknown to anybody except really the Secretary of State's office. And the changes we made last year were even more protective of the name and address of folks. Well, what ended up happening was that some of the county recorders and county people said that some of the parts of what we did were too difficult for them to implement, and the Secretary of State's office worked through the summer and the fall on getting agreement and amongst most of the folks that had issues. And so we were here today with those changes to make sure that it's easier for the counties to operate the changes that we made last year and to change some of those things so that it's easier built to implement. The Safe at Home program is a program where people can just have their address not disclosed to the general public, and they are basically able to get away from people that have been dangerous in their lives. And they get their mail at a Secretary of State's post office address, box address, and the Secretary of State's office then forwards their mail on to them. So we're trying to keep those addresses as private as possible. There are over 2,000 people that make use of this program, and I'm going to let the Secretary of State's office explain in better detail than what I just did what the bill contains. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser, Deputy Secretary of State. Thanks so much for your time today and for taking up this bill. As Senator Goodwin was explaining, the Safe at Home program is run by the Secretary of State's office. It's similar to programs in about 30 other states and currently has 1,600 people in it, which is about 700 households. And we expect the program to continue to grow until there are between 3,500 and 5,000 people in the program. The program is for people in very dangerous situations, and we provided some information to the committee today with profiles of a few of the participants in the programs. It includes people who have taken out orders for protection and had them violated repeatedly and felt like they needed to take another step, or people who have a woman who was attacked by her husband, and he attempted to murder her. He was incarcerated and is now out on parole. She feels a need, she and her family feel a need to take these extra steps to make their family safe. The law passed last year took great additional steps to ensure that participants can remain, can continue to have their data protected, and that if a government entity or a private entity, for that matter, has data on a participant, it allows the participant to notify the government entity that they, for their protection, need the data to be private. Private entities have not had a problem complying with the law. We have heard from some public entities that they would like to see some changes made, and that's what this bill does. This bill takes the law that we got passed last year and eases administration for local governments. And so I'm happy to walk through the A2 amendment, which makes these changes. The changes have to do with two different types of data, real property data and then other types of government data, and it deals with them a little bit separately. So the first sections of the bill basically separate identity data, data that would identify the person, from location data, which identifies where they can be found, and then treats those two types of data separately. And so it allows for identity data to be shared as private, to the extent private data is otherwise regularly allowed to be shared, but says that location data for safe at home participants continues to receive the extra protection passed last year. It also separates out real property data and requires separate notices for real property data versus other types of government data. That's what the first few subdivisions of the bill do, define location data and identity data and require separate notices. Then it gets in. It allows location data to be shared in certain circumstances. We worked very closely with the counties on the circumstances under which location data would need to be shared if a person has submitted a notice. And those are outlined here. But for the most part, location data, the default is that it cannot be shared for safe at home participants. It gets into real property records for the most part in subdivision 4A on line 3.27. Subdivisions 4A and 4B deal with real property records and basically say that counties are required to comply with the provisions of the law that say that identity data cannot be shared in connection with location data, but gives counties options for complying. And so it names a few options, such as potentially having a private index or masking some of the information, but does not require counties to comply in any one specific way. It also requires that if a real property notice is submitted to a county, that they provide that notice to our office so that when the person leaves the program, we are then able to inform the county recorder that the person has left the program and the real property data can, at that point, be made public. It also allows the Secretary of State to confirm or deny that a specific, whether a specific piece of real property is related to a safe-at-home participant. So, for example, if there was a participant named Susan Jones and they're trying to clear a title, we would have permission to say, no, that's not the same Susan Jones who's in the program, and they would know that that was not an issue and that the title could be insured. In Subdivision 6, it clarifies that service of process is sufficient if it's provided to the Secretary of State's office, and if publication is required, that it can be published without the participant's name. And Subdivision 7 allows local governments to consult with our office if they receive a notice. Otherwise, since it's private data, they might be prohibited from calling and saying, hey, I got a notice from Susan Jones. Let's talk about the steps I need to take. The final section of the bill says that the bill is effective the day following final enactment and clarifies that local governments that have taken these steps to comply with the law passed last year have not violated the law by doing so, or any law by doing so. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fraser. First of all, members, this is an author's amendment. This is the first stop of the bill.
I'll move the amendment, Mr. Chair.
So Senator Goodwin moves adoption of the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Are there any questions for Ms. Fraser relating to the contents of the bill now?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fraser or Senator Goodwin, in looking over the bill as amended, is there a cost to either an added cost to the state or to the counties involved?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, there is no substantive cost to the state. There's no fiscal note. There's no cost that couldn't be absorbed. And I would say that compared to the current law, the costs of complying with this bill are substantially lower for local governments than the current law that was passed last year. We do have representatives from local governments here who do plan to testify, so they could answer that as well. But that's my understanding, is that the goal of this bill is to make it easier for local governments to comply with the law than it is currently.
Ms. Fraser, do you know if the State Bar Association Real Property Law Section has taken a look at this?
Mr. Chair, I understand that they have taken a look at it.
Okay. And have you gotten any feedback from them?
Oh.
Or are they present to give it?
Mr. Chair, I believe that, again, this deals with two pieces. It deals with real property and it deals with other government data. And I think that there's general agreement on the other government data pieces. When it comes to real property, I think that the stakeholders are still trying to figure out whether exactly how they feel about it.
Okay. So let's go on with our other testifiers. And if there's anyone here affiliated with the Bar Association that can give us more information on that, that would be helpful too. I have on the list here Kimball Foster, Hennepin County Examiner of Titles. Foster, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kimball Foster. I am the Examiner of Titles for Hennepin County. In that position, I'm the legal advisor to the Registrar of Titles. And the Registrar is the filing office for documents for registered property, and the Registrar is also the County Recorder. The County Recorder is the recording office for real estate documents. Real estate documents are deeds, mortgages, liens, your typical real estate documents that you see in transactions. When deeds and mortgages are recorded, their intention is to make them notice to the public. And the county recorder or the registrar of titles will do so by entering them into a public index, giving them a document number, and then allowing persons to access that document number and consequently to view the document. The purpose for that is to make public notice of interests that encumber property. And that is significant to a number of entities. Private documents are important to buyers and sellers, the government, the title industry, contractors, mortgage lenders. A number of entities rely upon our public real estate records. To have private real estate records poses a risk of impacting negatively real estate commerce in the state of Minnesota. We have been meeting with the Secretary of State's office, and when I say we, I mean members of the various entities that are affected by the 2013 amendment to the Safe at Home Law. And it's members of the Hennepin County Bars, or the, I'm sorry, Minnesota State Bar Association Real Property Law Section Legislative Committee. members of the Minnesota Land Title Association, Minnesota County Recorders Association, maybe other entities too. I have to say that coming up with a solution that satisfies everybody has been elusive. There are many concerns here. The proposal before you is one proposal that has the goal of making documents for safe-at-home participants private, either in whole or in part, while still giving public notice of those documents, and then providing a mechanism for parties with a legitimate interest in seeing those documents to have access to them. It also provides some significant improvements to the 2013 legislation. Instead of having a general notice of safe-at-home participation, which is given to a responsible authority of a county, having an impact on the county recorder or the registrar, a special notice must be given, identifying the real estate with particularity. We know which property the participant needs to protect, and identifying with specificity who that participant is. So the example that Ms. Frazier gave of Susan Jones, we get more information about the Susan Jones who's in the program so that we can determine which records have to be protected. The amendment also provides that the county recording registrar don't have to go into the old records, records that have already been put of notice, and make those private. We don't have to seek those out and make them private because they have already been sold to bulk document buyers and are already in the public domain. It also provides a mechanism for or permission to make documents that have been private public once the person is either no longer in the program or no longer has an interest in the property. These are key amendments to the 2013 legislation and make it much easier for the county recorder and the registrar to comply while still protecting the integrity of our real estate records. Now, there may be other ways to accomplish those goals. Hennepin County is in favor of any solution that meets the two important goals of protecting the safety of violence victims and the integrity of our public real estate records.
Okay. Ms. Foster, you believe that this bill does that?
I do believe that this bill does that. I'm not saying that it can't be made better, and I would certainly like to put in any time or to seek additional input for anything that can make this bill the best that it can be.
Well, this is the first and only stop of this bill in this committee from here to the Senate floor. So if there are going to be any improvements made, this would be the committee to make them, unless there's a desire to sort things out on the Senate floor, which is a more complicated place to do this kind of work.
Mr. Chair, the concern is that if we don't do something to ameliorate the negative effects, unintended effects, I'm sure, of the 2013 amendments, that we have a situation that's very difficult for the county recorders and registrars to comply with. This goes a long way towards making their job easier to do while still protecting safe-at-home participants.
So you'd rather see this than nothing, but there are some things that you might contemplate could make it even better, and you'd like to keep working on that. Am I understanding you correctly?
Mr. Chair, yes to the first part. Definitely. We definitely need some amendments to help us comply with the 2013, to ameliorate those amendments. I think this is a good proposal. There may be other good proposals.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Foster. Any questions for Ms. Foster? Thank you. I also have on the testimony list Susan Roth from the Minnesota County Recorders Association, the Ramsey County Recorder. Welcome.
Good Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. I am Susan Roth. I am the Ramsey County Recorder, but I am here today wearing the hat of the Minnesota County Recorders Association. We are an association comprised of representative county recorders and registrars of title from all 87 counties. Our focus is to work on education and training issues, be compliant with statutes, share best practices, all with an effort to improve our office operations and remain compliant with state law and federal law. I'd like to thank the staff at the Office of the Secretary of State who have worked tirelessly with our organization and our members in efforts to improve this legislation. We do have shared goals, as Ms. Foster and others have suggested, which is to protect victims of violence, but at the same time keep all of our county land records public, as they have been for the last 150 years or so. In 2013, the amendments greatly increased the privacy protections, and by amending the Data Privacy Act, Data Practices Act, it barred dissemination of information by counties and local government. And this is information that is regularly available to the public all day, every day in our offices. In my particular county and in many others, we have electronic systems as well as an opportunity for the public to come in, not just come in remotely, but to come in physically to our offices and examine all of our records. We are required to provide access under state law to those records to the public all the time. And those records are relied on for a variety of business activities. Many of the documents that we have and we continue to receive include identity and location data. For example, if you think of your most recent real estate transaction when you bought or sold property, it included information about your name and address. There are liens that we receive from the federal government and from the State Department of Revenue that are for unpaid taxes or may involve other reasons, such as hospital liens, where interests are being protected and they refer to the name and the address of the party involved. Many of these documents that are also filed by, for example, roofers and plumbers who are providing services to homes, are brought into our office, and our standard has always been, under state law, we record what we are presented with. Statutes currently define what needs to be included in those documents, and we accept them for recording and make them public, and that is what our role has always been. We are required by statute to maintain an alphabetical index of the name of each grantor or grantee on a document.
Right. Ms. Roth, I don't mean to interrupt, but I'm going to ask you to please focus in on the amendment and the proposed solution that's before us.
The amendment that is before you continues to require the counties in the state of Minnesota to create a dual indexing system. All counties currently have a public indexing system. It provides name and location data, and our records are all imaged and available to the public to view. The amendment before you requires that we take some data and some documents that come into our office and treat them differently. It will prohibit people from examining records and having access to those records unless they follow the specific sequence as outlined in the amendment. And we are concerned that what that will mean is that it will inhibit commerce, that there will be difficulties within our offices in installing the technology in an effort to become compliant, and we may have a gap here. We have an effective date that is the day following enactment, and at present, all 87 counties would have to institute technology change or establish a private desk drawer or a locked safe answer in order to keep the records secure as required by this amendment. And that's a significant step for counties to undertake.
Okay, so I just want to try to make sure I understand what you're saying here. We have a current law that establishes this program. We passed it last year. Mm-hmm. It is statute, and the counties are presently required to comply with it.
That's correct.
So the question then before this committee is the bill doesn't propose to repeal that program.
Correct.
The bill proposes to change the manner in which the data is maintained in the counties. So given that premise, unless there's a movement here to repeal the overall program, the question is, do you wish to remain under current statute, or do you wish to be subject to the data maintenance requirements that are set forth in the amendment that's before the committee today? That's kind of the choice that the committee has to decide, and I'm asking for your opinion. Even though you've identified some issues overall with the whole construct, The choice before us today is this amendment, or if we don't pass this amendment, then the counties are still required to comply with current statute, which does require that dual record-keeping mechanism.
Mr. Chairman, I'm here on behalf of the County Recorders Association. Some of our members would respond that their preference would be to see this repealed until additional language could be worked out. Our position is we have worked closely with the office. We are making every effort to comply. We remain gravely concerned based on what our customers have told us, not looking solely at what will it cause us to have to do in our offices. This is not so much about county operations as it is about conflicting state statute and federal statute, ensuring we comply and making sure that the citizens in our counties continue to have access to real estate information.
All right. Are there any questions for Ms. Roth?
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Roth, you mentioned that there might be some technological changes that need to be made in certain counties. Would that be a cost factor that would be triggered for a county, or is it something that could be absorbed by a county that is, I guess what I'm asking is the technical changes an expensive fix, or is it something that's rather minor?
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Roth.
Senator, it will depend on the county. Currently, there are about 25% of Minnesota counties that use one software system provided by a vendor. Those counties recently, in the last couple of years, had a data breach where a hacker came in and peeled out information that they had thought was private and inaccessible. We make every effort as a county to comply. We ensure that our contracts with vendors do have and do contain privacy considerations, limitations on what can be accessed. But at this point, none of the 87 counties has something in place where we could tomorrow include in our current software system a private document, a private certificate of title, or mask the index that we're required to maintain. So it would depend if you were Martin County and you had a fairly low level of recording in terms of volume, the costs might be very different from one of the major metro area counties, but it would be a cost to all counties at this point.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Ms. Roth, you mentioned that you would not have access to certain property records, and I'm trying to imagine what consequence, at least to commerce, that would create. I can think off the top of my head perhaps complications to foreclosures, loans, banking issues, collateral, not to mention maybe some divorce settlements that might be involved. And am I understanding that correct, that this law may interfere with the processing of that type of either commerce or legal process? And is that what you're trying to tell us?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that is true. There's currently, for example, a foreclosure by advertisement statute in Minnesota, which would permit parties to foreclose a mortgage by advertising and publishing the name and address of the mortgagor. The alternative to that is court action. And if you can no longer publish the name and address, if that's not part of the public record that can then be used and put out there, we would be looking at court procedures, for example, for each foreclosure. And that might be a significant change. The other area where we see it is mortgages. If you've ever attempted to get a second mortgage or an additional small home loan against your property for remodeling, for example, they come and search the records. They want to know how many other mortgages might there be on your property. Are you a good risk? Is the collateral there? Again, it's a very common routine for builders who are putting up a new garage to come in and verify that you do own your property before they're willing to put a garage on your parcel. So there are a variety of circumstances. Nancy Landmark is here from the Minnesota Land Title Association, and she can also speak to the implications for title searches and what they can access and not access.
So, Ms. Fraser, I understood from your testimony that there were workarounds that are included in this amendment to enable the dots to be connected in those kind of inquiries. Is that not the case?
Mr. Chair, that is the case. And especially in the case of second mortgages, the amendment allows a participant to allow the data to be shared, to provide written permission for the data to be shared. And if the person is interested in getting a second mortgage, it's going to be in their interest to have the data viewable. I mean, obviously, they're not going to be, the bank's not going to approve a second mortgage without being able to see the data. And so they would, of course, sign the paperwork to allow the data to be shared under those circumstances. So we don't actually think that that's an issue. In terms of foreclosure, I mean, yes, it is possible that somebody in Safe at Home would purchase a home and go into foreclosure. We don't think that in those very limited circumstances, it's too much of a burden under those in those cases to have to go through judicial action to do the foreclosure.
So my understanding, then, I mean, again, there's the current statute that's going to require the counties to comply with the law. So the question I have for Ms. Roth is the amendment before us, or the bill that's before us, does it make it easier or harder for the counties to comply with the requirements under the law?
There are portions of the amendment, Mr. Chairman, that do make it much easier for counties, and there are important components that have been agreed to by other associational groups that we would like to see move forward. The creation of a private indexing system remains problematic for the Minnesota County Recorders.
But forgive me, but my understanding is that kind of creation is required under current statute, is it not?
Mr. Chairman, there is vagueness to the language that we were attempting to strengthen through our conversations with the Office of the Secretary of State. The old bill, as Ms. Foster testified, does have additional vagueness that makes it difficult. One of our goals as a County Recorders Association is to try to establish some uniformity among counties for business practices. We have customers who operate all over the state. They are in all of our counties, and we want to ensure that we're all providing good service and remain compliant with all statutes. The problem is when statutes conflict, it becomes difficult for us, and we are getting different advice from our county attorneys, from our examiner of titles, and from our customers who are also seeking advice from their attorneys on land transactions.
Okay. Any other questions for Ms. Roth? All right. Ms. Landmark has also signed up to testify. Nancy Landmark from the Minnesota Land Title Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me. I am Nancy Landmark, and I am here today in my role as co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Minnesota Land Title Association. In that context, I represent abstractors, title examiners, closers, and all people involved in the title insurance business, as well as the abstractors and closers. We work in our business and deal with title on a day-to-day basis. And when it comes to land, title has two simultaneous meanings. First, it means ownership of real estate. Secondarily, it means the ability to prove your ownership of real estate. And here in Minnesota, we have relied for the last 150 or so years on the public records maintained by the County Recorder's Office and Registrars of Titles Office to prove ownership of real estate. These public records are critical to doing so. That being said, we understand the need for protection for participants in the program, and we support protection for them. Our association believes if the world were ideal, we wouldn't have this law apply to the real estate records. It does, however, apply today. The impact of the law as it is currently in effect is that if there is a participant in a county, and we as examiners know that there are some documents that could pertain to real estate and we don't know who is involved in them or what real estate they affect, it has the possible effect of making title to everybody's real estate in that county unmarketable. It's not just affecting the participants. The proposed changes and the bill that is before you today make five small but significant steps towards improving this situation. It requires a specific notice to the county recorder or registrar of title, which includes the specific legal description of the property that is affected by the notice. Secondly, it will only apply prospectively to documents. It will not apply to matters that are already of record. Third, it requires some type of notice in the tract index, which is one of the indices that must be maintained by the county recorders so that we can identify that this property is, in fact, affected by these private documents. And last but not least, as we are doing our research and we are required to search both the tract index and the grantor-grantee index, if we run across a name in the process that raises red flags and has private data associated with it, we have the ability to go to the Secretary of State's office to obtain confirmation that the record in question does not affect the real estate with which we are dealing. Yes, these are big steps in the right direction. The bill, as amended, is not perfect. We will be back. We will continue discussions, and hopefully we will get to the point where we can find a solution that keeps the public record public while providing the necessary protection to participants. And we will continue to work with the Secretary of State's office in those efforts. On behalf of the Minnesota Land Title Association, then, I tell you that while the bill is not perfect, we support its passage because it's an improvement over what was there.
Thank you, Ms. Landmark.
Any questions for Ms. Landmark? Not from you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Ms. Landmark, you say that it's not perfect. Will that imperfection cause any delays in some of the commerce issues that I raised with the last testifier regarding foreclosures, banking issues, mortgage processes, divorce decrees, anything like that?
Yes, sir. There will be delays caused by all of them. If we are examining title to a piece of property in a county where there is a participant, there is the potential that every exam will be delayed as we turn to the Secretary of State's office for a determination that, in fact, the participants do not affect the property that we are looking at. The bill provides a 2-day turnaround time for that, but with the current rate of particularly residential transactions, they move very fast. From the day they come into our office, sometimes they're closing in a week, sometimes it's several months. If we're delaying 2 days before we can get our title commitments out and let people know what the status of title is, it delays everything. On the foreclosure side of things, and I will address this from my own personal opinion, if you'll forgive me, Senator, because I was in private practice for many years, and I did do foreclosure work. The conflict between the requirement in this act, even as amended, that you not publish the private data, the name and address of the participant, and the legal description also gives location data, so that also can't be published, means that we will delay and extend the time frame involved in foreclosures. We will add a significant burden to the court system as they process judicial foreclosures. I don't know what the cost of that will be because I don't have a good handle on that cost, sir. But the general time frame for a foreclosure by advertisement is 6 weeks published notice, followed by a sale date, followed by 6 months while the borrower has the right to redeem and either maintain the property themselves or sell it to a third party. A typical judicial foreclosure will take between, the last I heard was around a year, and then you still have the 6 months afterwards. Is it a delay? Yes. Is it an increased cost? Yes. It increases the cost for the lender in terms of the initial foreclosure cost. It increases the cost for the borrower because they have to pay more to redeem. And it slows the transfer of property.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
You know, many of you know I've been in a real estate agent for 35 years now. I hate to admit that, but one of the elements of any real estate transaction is something called time of essence. time of essence is very critical to transacting a sale. And if the time of essence is not recognized, the transaction could fail for a variety of reasons. So as we consider this bill, and we certainly want to protect those that are being threatened with violence at home, we also, it shouldn't be an absolute trade-off necessarily with slowing down some type of transaction. Now, I can understand there are cases when it could be extreme and we have to move quickly. But I'm hesitant to support this right now because of the collateral consequences that may occur to commerce. And I don't think one should be exchanged one for another. I would imagine we're bright enough to make this all work. So I don't know if this is ready for prime time or not. But maybe as we continue to ferret this out, we can come to a conclusion one way or the other.
Mr. Chair, and
Senator Goodman
and Senator Limmer, we can do that. We have a short session here, and I think that there's pretty much agreement that they don't want it left the way that it is right now because they will have to abide by current law if we don't change this. And it sounds like there may be some tweaking that has to happen in the future. But certainly for now, this is going to be a whole lot better for them than what they have to abide by now. Another thing is let's not forget that the people that are in this program are people that are being protected from bodily harm. It's children. A lot of these people are children that are being protected from bodily harm or death. I think a little inconvenience on part of the counties is worth that. We got 30 states that are doing this now. Why can't Minnesota county recorders do this? Why can't they say, okay, and we got 87 counties. We don't have these homes in 87 counties. We have these homes in a few counties. So if they have a case once the blue moon, that's going to be a foreclosure. We're talking about a minor possibility, quite frankly. And we're going to trade all that off. We're going to trade the safety of people off because they don't want to not publish the name of somebody that could be abused or killed. I'm sorry, but I don't have a lot of sympathy for that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, I don't know if you heard me. I preempted my comments about my concern for people that are threatened with violence. And what we're trying to do is find the balance point of how to make this work for everybody, not at the expense of someone. And so we're sitting down at a somewhat round table and trying to figure out how to do this. I certainly can understand and I share your passion for protecting those that are in a shadow of harm. But at the same time, I'm hoping we can do better work and work out some of these complexities. You know, you could also talk about the family that needs desperately shelter that may not get a real estate closing because of a delay. And so I'm trying to find that balance where we can do the very best for everyone.
Well, Mr. Chair and
Senator Goodman
and Senator Limmer, I just want to say that I think that the Secretary of State's office has gone way out of their way to make sure that they could do the best possible thing by both, by the counties and by the people in this program. And I don't think the counties that have been involved with that would deny that. And it seems like people say that it could be tweaked, it could be better, but nobody has said really how it can be better. It sounds like the only way it can be better is if we keep allowing people to, allowing the counties to let this information be public. And that's not okay. So if they don't come up with, you know, some kind of a change that really does protect these people and makes it easier for them, then we need to do this. We need to do this now for the counties, so that they aren't having the problems that they had this last year.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Limmer.
Thank you, sir. Senator Limmer, one area of concern with not acting at this time is that the law that was passed last session already has these impacts and potential impacts on commerce throughout the state. We had discussed with the Secretary of State's office asking for a one-year delay in the effectiveness on the real estate records so that we would have time to find an ideal solution. We discussed possibilities of setting up a type of entity that somebody could own real estate through so that the public record could stay intact. But we discovered that there were difficulties with obtaining financing. And so we're trying to continue to work through some of those things, but we don't have the final answers. The bill is a step in the right direction. My personal preference from an association perspective and a user of the real estate records is I'd love to see them all public, but that's not what the law says today. The bill before you is a step in the right direction, though certainly if you were to suggest holding off on having it affect the real estate records for a year while we worked out to this, my association would not object to that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dietzick.
If she has a question or answer, she can go first.
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out, in terms of the need for the two-day turnaround and the need to check out with our office if a property is impacted, I mean, that would only be under circumstances where a participant owned property in that county and there was something in the records that implied that there was a connection between that property or that participant and the property in question. I mean, it's not like if there's a participant in the county that they're going to need to call every time, because if it's Warren Limmer is the person buying the property and the only participant in the county has a different name and is at a different property, there would not be a need to call or this two-day delay. The current law says that both identity data and location data are private. So it would make it very difficult, and some would say probably impossible, to put any note in the record that in the grantor-grantee index that there is a participant in the program or in the tract index. So it under current law. And so this is, I think, from the land title people's perspective, from the county's perspective, a huge step in the right direction in terms of allowing commerce, in terms of allowing public notice that there is a record with private data associated with it. Without changes, there is no record, there's no note, and I think it does raise questions about all of the properties. So I think everyone is in agreement that this is something that should be done this year.
All right. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will first say that I had this bill last year, and so we had three stops. We were in judiciary, we were in state and local, and we were in State Department Finance. So I am a little disappointed that the County Attorneys Association and the Counties Association and others didn't, you know, bring us the attention, because we did make changes last year. And I was open to making any and all changes because it was about protecting people but making it a workable situation. So I'm, you know, a little bit disappointed in that. But I think to move this forward, because I would like to find a solution, my question is, and I'm sorry, I might have missed of where the next stop, does this go right to the floor or is there another stop? And then where is it in the House? Because if changes could be made in the House bill, and then keeping it moving forward and keeping discussions moving forward to just keeping it along but not stopping it. I'm just kind of curious.
Senator Dietzick, because of the narrower focus of this bill compared to the broader one you carried last year, the judiciary is its only stop. In a committee, it goes straight to the Senate floor from here. I don't know where it is in the House.
Mr. Chair and members, there was scheduled to be a hearing in the House this week, and we asked to have it postponed to give additional time for discussion so that if additional changes can be agreed to, they are still possible to be made this year, and then obviously ultimately in discussion with the Senate, potentially in conference committee. But there is opportunity to have some additional discussions and possibly changes on the House side.
That said.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would just, you know, encourage people to keep talking, because I think that we all agree that something needs to be done to protect people, but we also don't want to stop commerce and then find a way for this to be effective and easy on the counties and the people that use the records.
Thank you. Is the State Bar Association present and able to give us any guidance on the real property section, Mr. Dunleavy?
Senator Lotz, my name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section. And this bill hasn't gone through the formal Bar Association process, so I'm only, I don't know if I'm speaking as a private attorney or as the chair of the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section, but one of those two things. We've had a bunch of meetings in my office with the previous testifiers, with a different representative from the Secretary of State's office, but all the previous testifiers and a few other people in the room, and we tried to figure out a way to make this work. Our original preference, the Real Property Section, was that there would be a delayed effective date so that we'd have more time to figure out the least bad alternative. And there's conflicting public policy goals here of the protection of the participants and public data, marketability of transactions, marketability of titles. We're focused on marketability of title. That's like one of our goals as a Real Property Section. And a concern about this bill is the perfection and the priority of the interest, not only of the participants, but also of, for example, mortgage lenders. If the system, which the present system doesn't really give any guidance to the county recorders, and in the counties where there have been participants, they're doing things. I don't know if the county recorders really have the statutory authority to do what they're doing. And this is a big step in the direction of trying to give county recorders some guidance and some authority to protect the program participants. But our goal is that we don't want this to negatively affect all the titles in the county, and we also want it so that the participants can go out and get mortgage loans. If their mortgages aren't perfected, if they don't have priority, if there isn't constructive notice, then they're not going to be able to get title insurance. They're not going to be able to finance transactions because the title companies aren't going to give title insurance. The banks aren't going to give loans. So we want that to happen. What we don't want is to have wide variation in what the counties do, because we practice all throughout the state. We want the counties to have similar programs that work. Redacting documents maybe isn't the best solution. The Karen Johnson, I like to pick on Karen Johnson because I went to high school with her instead of, probably everyone in this room did, but If Karen Johnson in Hennepin County has a federal tax lien and her name gets redacted off that federal tax lien, then suddenly that tax lien affects every property in the county. There has to be a way to keep that from happening, negatively affecting all the titles in the state or in the county. I would like to see consensus with the counties. I think there is a fair amount of consensus with the groups that have testified today, and I have to thank Kim Foster, the first testifier. She did yeoman's work in drafting a lot of this, and I'd say that what we've got now is probably the least bad alternative. It definitely needs work. I would really like to see the counties have consensus. As far as why this wasn't caught last year, none of the trade associations, none of the industry associations that are involved in real estate were aware of this legislation last year, or we would have been at the table last year. The Bar Association, the title companies, the county recorders, we all would have been here last year.
All right, any questions for Mr. Dunleavy? Thank you, sir. Any further discussion on Senate File 2277 as amended? Senator Goodwin, you renew your motion?
Yes, I renew my motion to pass Senate File. What's your number again?
277.
Oh, yeah. 2277 as amended to be passed to the floor.
All right. Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 2277 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Mm-hmm. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Goodwin. All right, we're going to circle members, back
and
to.
And by the way, that was my simple bill for this session.
Senator Marty, we're going to go back to item two on the agenda, Senate File 2053, Minnesota Public Benefit Corporation Act.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill is something that's been various shapes and sizes of this bill been around for about 10 years. I've been working on it. It's a bipartisan effort. Matter of fact, when the Republicans took control of the majority, work with former Senator Chris Gerlach, who authored the bill 2 or 3 years ago. The biggest change from all those previous efforts and now is that the State Bar Association and Tim Lowe, who's sitting to my left, approached last year and said, you know, we're really interested in this idea, and would you mind if we work over this? They weren't supportive of it. They were kind of, had a lot of concerns, and they felt we ought to take a look at it. When we first started talking about this, nobody was doing it. We would have been the first state. Now, I believe there are 21 other states, including, as of last summer, state of Delaware, that gives us an option. It's basically, to explain it very briefly, it's a way that businesses that would have entrepreneurs with an explicit social purpose could incorporate under this new Chapter 304A. We rely on all the general corporate statutes in 302A, except for the provisions in this bill, which would be specific to them. They would have the ability to factor this in other words, not factoring in just the highest rate of return for their shareholders, but also other stakeholders, whether it's the community, their employees, their customers, or whomever, and they could factor this in. Currently, if an entrepreneur wants to start and grow a social business, they have trouble doing so, one, because the corporate forms we have some legal constraints to it, and secondly, they have to create a whole bunch of customized documents to work for their own business, which means hiring a lawyer or a lot of lawyers to do a lot of complex work. We're trying to make it simple so a small entrepreneur can do this without legal things, and it also enables them to, I think one of the benefits is we reduce the risk of liability by doing it this way, and the current corporate entity forms do not distinguish social businesses for the sake of their vendors, their investors, their customers, and so on, and this would make that happen, and when Ms. Lowe and the bar, corporate section of the bar, approached me, they said they were going to put in a lot of work on this, and I thought, who's going to turn down an offer like that? And I showed up at a couple of their 7 in the morning meetings every other week for about 9 months. I didn't show up at many, and it was largely over my head, but I got to say, I think they came up with by looking at all the other states, I think they came up with the best structure for this in the country, and I'm going to urge support for it. And there is an A12 amendment, a technical amendment to it, but I'll offer that and then turn it over to Kim Lowe from Frederickson and Byron.
Thank you. Senator Marty, is this your first committee stop on the bill?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
All right, then this is an author's amendment. The KP12 amendment has been handed out to members, so it looks like it is technical changes in statutory references, by and large. Any questions about the KP12 amendment? Senator Hall moves adoption of the amendment.
Yep.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion fails. Amendment's adopted. Ms. Lowe, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. As Senator Marty said, my name is Kim Lowe. I'm a shareholder at Frederickson and Byron in Minneapolis. I'm also the chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association's drafting committee that put together this legislation with Senator Marty's help. We've been working on this process for 2 years now. We have been watching, collectively, the business law section, nonprofit lawyers, for-profit lawyers, other lawyers in the transactional world, have been watching this legislation that Senator Marty has put through several times, generally opposing it on the grounds that we didn't think it would quite work with our system. So when I approached Senator Marty last year, our offer was to say, you know, let's do this. Let us look at this the way we look at all of our transactional business law statutes in the state of Minnesota, which we have a history of doing that in a very robust manner. I say that robust because this is my first time chairing one of these, but I had a lot of guidance from other practitioners that have done this process, and I think the fact it only took us 9 months is actually pretty good compared to other legal statutes here in the Twin Cities or in the Minneapolis. I just want to say first and foremost that this has been endorsed by the Minnesota State Bar Association, has been endorsed by the business law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, the nonprofit orgs section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, and the corporate section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. So it has sort of been blessed by all of those who deal with it on a regular basis. I want to just give you a brief overview because I get a lot of questions about benefit corporations, and I think the easiest way for me to communicate this to you is to just answer five brief questions. Senator Marty did a great job of laying out what is a benefit corporation. I think the biggest thing to remember when you're talking about or thinking about a public benefit corporation is that this is a for-profit enterprise that has a social purpose added onto it, that the entrepreneurs or the investors or the shareholders have elected in their governing documents to add some social purpose on top of their for-profit entity. It functions in the for-profit world. It does not have any tax incentives, doesn't have any structural difference from any other for-profit business. And I think it's important to remember because I often get questions about how does this fit in with nonprofits and for-profits. But this is clearly a profit-generating, profit-motivated business. As Senator Marty said, 21 other states as of today have passed legislation allowing these sorts of entities. I regularly watch other states. There's probably 5 to 7 right now in process. So probably by next summer, we'll probably have over 30 states that have this sort of legislation. Right now, we have business owners here in Minnesota that want to do this. If they want to do this, they can just go to one of these other states and do it. We have sort of a porous activity when it comes to business formation. So without having a statute here in the state of Minnesota, we're just forcing our own entrepreneurs to just go to another state. Well, that doesn't really make a lot of sense for us as practitioners, and it also doesn't make a lot of sense for us as a state. If there's businesses to be formed here and people want to do it, we should have a statute that allows them to do that. So that's really why, if we really think about it, Minnesota at this point needs to pass a statute because 21 other states have already done it. The third question is why? What does our statute do that's different? Our process, we had the benefit, and I'm very happy we didn't go first. Sorry, Senator Marty. I know you really wanted to be first, but the benefit of not going first is we've had really a lot of insight from what other states have done. We were able to look at model legislation. We were able to look at Delaware's legislation, California's legislation, all these different states, and really pick and choose sort of the best examples that work with our current corporate structure, corporate law structure, and what's out there in the whole world of benefit corporations. So we're very happy. I know I sound like I'm patting myself on the back, but we're very happy with the legislation that's before you because we think it's unique, and we think it answers a lot of the different questions that are left unopened in other state legislation. And that's because of the timing that we had to work on it and the timing of where it falls within the passage of these sort of bills. It's important to remember, and I get this question all the time, is that this legislation builds in a transparency mechanism that doesn't exist in a lot of other states. If someone forms a benefit corporation under Minnesota, if this legislation passes and they form a benefit corporation under Minnesota law, they're required annually to submit a report to the Secretary of State. That report requires them to report against what they said they were going to do. So if they commit to a social purpose in their articles of incorporation, every year they provide this report to the Secretary of State that says, how did we do? And they really provide their own report card. And this is a publicly available document. And that's the difference with this sort of enterprise entity than compared to other states. Other states have a reporting mechanism maybe to shareholders or maybe to stakeholders, but we have one that is put in place, a reporting mechanism out into the public or into the crowd where people can take a look at it and judge these businesses for themselves. And that's really the difference on our legislation and what we think is important. When you ask when business really wants something special, then we think there's some obligation to report out as well.
Ms. Lowe?
Sure.
Is part of the goal of that is almost a consumer protection goal, that if a business is marketing themselves, promoting themselves as a public benefit entity, that they've got this additional charitable purpose, if you will, that
come buy products from us because we're good for this charitable purpose as well. Then there's that accountability mechanism. The public can actually go to the Secretary of State site and see what it is at least the business is documenting. Is that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's exactly what it's for. It really allows the consumer, the investor, the public to have access to this, their report on what they say they're doing and what they're doing. Now, it doesn't mean that the state's policing what people are doing in these type of businesses, but it means that it's available for the public and the consumers to say, wait a minute, I thought you told me you're only going to source locally and buy, you know, honey made from bees that are, I don't know, you can name any sort of thing that you want to name. And then the public report allows the consumers to go back and double check and say, you, this was the brand proposition you sold us on. We want to make sure you're, one, doing what you say you did, and two, you're not trying to put one over on us, with the term we use, greenwashing, is really what that concept is. So this accountability mechanism is really meant to make sure that if an entrepreneur wants to use the benefit of forming one of these entities, then they also have to have the responsibility of reporting out on that. And that's really what it's meant to do.
Ms. Lowe, is there any consequence stated in the bill if a company were to falsely report something to the Secretary of State's office?
Mr. Chair.
I'm sourcing locally, and they're saying they're sourcing locally, but it turns out they're really not, and if there were some investigation or something were to determine they didn't, is there a consequence other than public credibility?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. And we debated this for months. The makeup of our drafting committee included a lot of litigators who really fight hard to make sure that they can bring lawsuits against anybody who they might want to. And so we really focused on this question over and over again. And so the mechanism that's in place here says that if one of these business owners files a report that contains a false statement, it's subject to the same claims of perjury or detriments or punishment for perjury that any other report that's falsely filed to the Secretary of State would have. It does not create a mechanism for any state authority or agent to go out there and start policing these mechanisms. So there's no consumer, the same consumer fraud protections are there that are there for any other business that lies about what they're doing. And that's no different than any other business. But the reporting mechanism really is if they lie, then, of course, you can't lie on reports you file with the state. I mean, that's just a given. And so there's that mechanism. And so I would guess it would be a county attorney or what have you wants to pursue them, they can do that. But it also allows, I think, what it allows is for the public to have access. And they're going to say, wait a minute, they can check it out. We know the press is out there. They do all sorts of stuff. And so we know that that's really the shame factor will be what will affect these sorts of businesses more than a policing mechanism that would cost the state money to enforce, which is not what this is meant to do.
Thank you. Go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
May I ask a question? Just before you, just to make sure I understand what you're talking about here generally. I need to understand what you're talking about as a social benefit. What is the definition of that? Is this a distribution that's made from the profits of the company pre-tax, or is it something that's spent and not before distributions are made to shareholders as a profit that's spent for a social purpose before it's distributed to the tax holders? And I really want to know what you're talking about is the limitations of a social benefit. How do you define that? How do you limit that? And how do you make certain that it and where it's located in the tax process is particularly important to me.
Ms. Lowe.
Mr. Chair, Senator, as I stated earlier, this is not a creature of tax. This is not meant to have any implication on the tax code or how things are impact. It doesn't impact how a business operates and how it otherwise deals with charitable contributions. That's not the intent of this legislation. What these entities do depends on what they pledge, what they commit to in their social commitment. So if, say, one business says, I just heard the perfect example this morning, Newman's Own. We all have heard about Newman's Own, right? Their brand proposition is that they donate all of their profits to charity. So that's what they say they do. I heard it just on the commercial today. So if they were a benefit corporation formed under Minnesota law, under this statute, they would, however they want to do that for tax planning purposes, is not implicated by this bill. But if they said, we will donate all of our profits to charity, they would then report out and say, we donated 100% of our profits to charity, or they say, you know, we donated 50%, and this is why we didn't do the rest. It doesn't implicate anything with respect to the taxability of that donation, what have you. They would still have to make that determination that they would be donating it to a charity. It's important to remember with these sort of enterprises is the definition of social is not limited to charitable, because that's a very distinct difference. And we wanted to make sure when we drafted this legislation, which makes it very different than other states, that we allowed entrepreneurs to have that option or that choice to say, you know, what I think is social is not necessarily what the IRS says is charitable. So we will have some, I mean, I have people coming to me all the time who want to set up a social business. And their social business proposition may be, I want to locally source from, you know, farmers here in Minnesota that only grow on 10 acres of land and it's all organic. That's not a charitable activity. That's a social proposition. So it really is meant to capture those ideas of social that are not what the IRS deems to be charitable.
And this will follow
Senator Sherman.
So if I had a corporation and I wanted to, and I could, as a part of the disclosure of the people that I'm going to expend resources for a political party because it's going to do social good, is that allowable in this structure?
Question.
Mr. Chair, to the extent a for-profit business can do that now, these businesses can do that as well. There's nothing that changes that from the current law that impacts for-profit businesses. And so to the extent that's the law today for a for-profit business, it would be the exact same for this organization, for this type of entity.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Marty.
Can I interrupt for 1 second? Senator Sherman, in terms of thinking of instead of their resources going there, think of it in terms of if the example she gave, they wanted to source from organic farms or something. It may cost more to buy certain products because of who made them or how they were produced or whatever. And their shareholders may say, hey, wait, you're cutting into our profits by buying more expensive things. Or we decide we want to treat our employees better. We're going to pay them more than the market would justify. Well, our shareholders could sue that company under a traditional one because you're not maximizing their profit. If they say we want to do something for the good of our workers or for the community or our customers or something goes beyond what the market would normally bear, they may choose to form this kind of corporation. And then their investors are investing in them knowing we may not make as much profit under that. And we can't sue them for taking care of this. That's in their charter. That's in their articles of incorporation. That's in the policy. That's why you chose to invest in us. So it's not so much what they're going to do with the money afterwards. It's how they're going to run their business, what the purpose of their business is. And we may not make as much profit because one of our other goals or other goal is to be either a general or a specific public benefit corporation. Does that help?
Senator Sherman.
I think that's a great idea. I'm just not sure if there's some other, I have to think about whether or not there's some other unintended kind of opportunities here that might not be in the, that are described, manipulate the description of something as a public benefit that in fact is not. And if it, and I don't, I heard you say there's not a tax benefit in this, so that would be certainly a motivating force.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know in the other 31 states, is there a list of companies that have entered into this that we could just look at because it would give us some idea of what their charitable options are?
Ms. Law.
Or social
law. Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Senator Hall, I'm going to defer that question to our resident social entrepreneur who has been looking at a lot of this. I just want to reiterate that this bill is not about a charitable purpose. It is about a social purpose.
Right.
And I think we have to be very cautious. We have to just recognize that we have nonprofits that do charitable work. They're over here. This is really part of that sort of hybrid middle where it might be social, like we were talking about, a sourcing concept, but it doesn't necessarily fall into the charitable. They may say we're going to give all our profits to charity. That's clear, but that one is. But I just want to make sure that we're clear on that.
Yes.
So I'm going to turn that question over to Jeff, if that's okay.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Mr. Oaks.
I have not introduced myself with testimony yet, but I will answer your question first before I do that. This is a very new
form. State your name for the record.
My name is Jeff Oaks, and I'm a social entrepreneur. This is a very new form, a corporate form. It was first passed in Maryland in 2010, I believe. 21 states have since adopted it. And it's a very young, emerging sector of the economy. So there are not a lot of, you know, major high-profile companies that we can point to and all know immediately. That said, there are definitely companies that you might be familiar with. I think locally we all are familiar with Rasmussen Business College. Or I don't know if it's a business college. They're incorporated in Delaware, and they just recently changed forms to the Public Benefit Corporation. So that is one that I think a lot of people are familiar with. It's very difficult to answer how many companies have incorporated as public benefit corporations nationally, and to provide a list like that for a lot of different reasons. One of them is that the reporting that each Secretary of State's office does is very different. Some of them do not count them or allow them to be counted separately from traditional business corporations for reporting purposes. So it's very difficult to go and find a number how many of these have actually been incorporated nationwide yet. So that's a hard statistic to find. The most recent research that I have seen was done in last summer, and there was an estimate of about 250 at that point. But we estimate, just given that Delaware has come on and what I know about that, to be about 400 legally incorporated public benefit corporations nationwide.
Senator Hall.
So there is no list out there that we could kind of take a look at?
There is no comprehensive list of public benefit corporation incorporated companies. There are other certifications that exist in this ecosystem that are easier to find and search, but those are not the same as a legal incorporation of a public benefit corporation.
Okay.
We will do a follow-up, and we will give you a list of some of them that we can find that sure. that I think
Thank
model
you.
What this is about.
So if I understand correctly, there are really two main advantages here. One would be for the business's ability to market as being a socially advantageous business. They could still do that as for-profit, but this would become part of their mission. Secondly would be that the owners of the business, their fiduciary duty would include advancing the social purpose in addition to advancing the for-profit purpose, so they couldn't be subject to a shareholder lawsuit alleging that they were not simply maximizing profits. The third advantage, just advancing social purposes if they wish to do so. Senator Marty.
And Mr. Chairman, first, I came across this concept, I think Ms. Pontius was here back in 1987 or 88 when Dayton Hudson Corporation at the time was subject to a hostile takeover, and the state actually, we wrote into our corporate statutes a one little paragraph saying, because Dayton Hudson actually gave away 5% pre-tax profit, and some of the takeover folks were saying, hey, we can make more money for the shareholders by doing this. So we actually allowed them to factor in other stakeholders like their customers, the community, and so on. But this way the corporation would be able to be founded based on this, so investors would not be tricked into anything. They would know exactly what they're getting into, customers and employees. We write it in. It's a much more transparent way of doing it.
Thank you. I hope we've covered a lot of what you wanted to say, Ms. Love. Keeping my eye on the clock, too. So let's, if we can move to Mr. Oaks to give us your testimony.
Thank
please.
You, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Oaks, and I'm a board member of the Social Enterprise Alliance Twin Cities. I'm also a social entrepreneur. I've had experiences with startups in multiple sectors. I first founded a nonprofit organization called Breakthrough Twin Cities. More recently, I invented and commercialized a product that won major awards and is now internationally distributed. And now I'm working on launching a social business, which is, for a lot of intents and purposes, the same as any normal business, but we have a social purpose that is explicit, and we track our progress towards meeting that purpose. I'm testifying today because this forum will help me individually, but I'm also testifying on behalf of a growing community of entrepreneurs who are interested in starting up these kinds of businesses, and also investors who are looking to invest in these types of businesses. This forum is going to help Minnesota's social business entrepreneurs in three different ways, from my perspective. The first is that it's going to decrease startup expenses as well as legal uncertainty, and both of those are very critical for a lot of different reasons. The second reason that this is important is that the Public Benefit Corporation Forum is going to give these entities a distinct identity in the broader economy. And what that will help to do is to develop an ecosystem of investors as well as other service providers that are needed to support and to nurture these kinds of organizations. And the third is that passing this bill is going to allow entrepreneurs to start these kinds of businesses here in Minnesota, where we live, where we do business, instead of having to go to a state with which we're less familiar. I'd also like to share with you at this point that we have the support of 8 endorsing organizations, one of which Kim has mentioned is the Minnesota State Bar Association. The others include the Office of the Secretary of State, the Co Roundtable, Social Enterprise Alliance, Twin Cities, Impact Angels Investment Group, Growth and Justice, Legal Corps, and the Social Justice Commission of St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Edina. And we actually anticipate that we're going to continue to grow that list as this session continues. And at this point, I'd also just like to recognize those who made it a point to be here today. So if you did come and support, would you please just raise your hand? We have a growing group of people who are very excited about this and who have made it a point to be here today. On behalf of this group, as well as those who couldn't be, I just would urge you to support the creation of public benefit corporations in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Oaks. I'm going to ask the committee if there are any questions or comments relating to this proposal. Senator Hall.
Thank you. I have one other question. And maybe it's been asked, but I didn't quite get the response. Who makes the final determination what the social benefit is going to be? Is it the owner? Is it the shareholders altogether? Board, who makes that?
Ms. Lowe.
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. The way the statute is drafted is that if it's a startup entity, the incorporator would include that in the articles of incorporation. So that would be the founding group of shareholders or whoever is forming the entity. If it's an existing corporation that wants to change, sort of opt into this status, then it would be the shareholders of that existing corporation would make that decision, and it has to be 2/3 of those shareholders, not a majority, but a supermajority, would be the ones to make the decision as to whether or not they, what the purpose is and whether they want to do it or not. The same thing goes if they want to opt out of the system. It's 2/3 of the shareholders who get the right to make that decision, and if they don't, If they oppose it, we have the same right. We have dissenters' rights and all the other protections that shareholders have under our current statutes to protect them, the minority shareholders, or all of that as well. So okay. It does allow for that shareholder group to the extent it's an existing organization.
Thank you.
Any further questions or comments? Right, Senator Sharon, would you like to move the bill?
I would.
So Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 2053 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, members Senator of the Martin. Committee, thank you very much. This is, after many years of doing this, it really helps to have the Bar Association take a look at it and make sure there aren't those unintended consequences that Senator Sharon said she wants to be careful about. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Next bill up will be Senator Sharon's bill, Senate File 2027 on e-cigarette regulations. I will note the other two bills on the agenda, Senate Files 1757 and 2108, of which I'm the chief author. We will do our best to get to them. I can't guarantee we're going to get to them today because we will adjourn at 2:30. If we do not get to them today, we will reconvene and they'll be on tomorrow's agenda at noon. All right, and we will reverse the order of those two bills on the agenda as well. So if we get to any of them, the first one up will be Senate File 2108, dealing with sales representatives agreements, and the second then would be the indemnity agreements, 1757. So we'll see how quickly this next bill goes, and we'll take it from there. Senator Sharon, we have Senate File 2027. We have a couple of specific provisions that are within the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. So we will ask you and the members to focus on the areas within our jurisdiction. And now, are you coming from another committee, or is this the first?
No, we're coming. We've been heard in Health and Human Services policy.
Okay.
We're coming here, and then from here, I think we go to state and local government.
All right. So,
maybe to commerce or state and local government. I don't know where we go next.
Yeah, I have state and local government as the next stop, and then commerce following that. Okay. So, members of the committee and audience. There will be other places to look at other issues in this bill, so we're going to focus the Judiciary Committee on the provisions that relate to our jurisdiction. Do you want to identify for us? I'm going to ask counsel to identify those provisions for us, and then we'll have Senator Sharon introduce the. Unless Senator Sharon, you want to say something first?
I wanted to make sure. Did you want me to go through the provisions that are under the jurisdiction here, or just a general overview of the bill?
Well, maybe if you could give just a 2-minute general overview of the bill, so we put it all in context. And then, I mean, if you want to go through the provisions that are within this committee's jurisdiction, or I can have Mr. Backus do that, whatever your preference is as chief author.
I think that the bill is pretty simple in terms of its content. So I can simply say that it takes the existing language in the Freedom to Breathe Act, the Clean Indoor Air Act, and adds into that language electronic delivery device language, so that electronic delivery device and the vapor that is exhaled from it is treated in the same way as tobacco. And that's essentially what this bill does, thereby prohibiting the use of the product, the exhaling of the vapor in indoor spaces in the same way we restrict tobacco. That's the first provision. And then there are other provisions in the bill that restrict the sale to minors and require it to be sold behind the counter. And the provisions that this committee will be specifically interested in applies the same penalty structure to this product as to other products that we are concerned people will inhale in enclosed places. And that's essentially what the bill is about.
Thank you. Mr. Backus, did you want to add anything to those comments in terms of our jurisdiction?
Mr. Chair and members, I think we would have the primary jurisdiction over Sections 6 and 7. Those are the kind of conforming changes being made to the criminal code. And then we would also have jurisdiction, I believe, over Section 3, Subdivisions 2 to 6, which deal, we wouldn't probably have primary jurisdiction there, but at least secondary jurisdiction. Those deals with administrative penalties, compliance checks, checks and defenses, but primarily Sections 6 and 7.
So, Senator Sharon, if you would just identify for us, for those provisions, tell us exactly what those provisions do.
Beginning with Section 6 then, Subdivision 1A extends the existing penalty for sale of tobacco to persons under the age of 18 to the sale of tobacco-related devices or electronic delivery services, or what we're calling e-cigarettes. Subdivision 2 extends the applicable penalty for a first violation, misdemeanor, and subsequent violations, gross misdemeanor, to anyone who furnishes electronic delivery devices to a person under the age of 18. It extends the applicable penalty, the misdemeanor, to a youth under the age of 18 who purchases or attempts to purchase an electronic delivery device using a driver's license or other form of false identification to misrepresent their age. Subdivision 3 under Section 6 extends the applicable penalty, which is petty misdemeanor, for possession, ingestion, purchase, or an attempt to purchase tobacco to include possession, ingestion, purchase, or attempt to purchase tobacco-related devices. So it adds that particular product by an adult for training.
Or electronic delivery.
Electronic delivery device, right. So it just repeatedly in the bill, you see, adds that language to those provisions. And Subdivision 5, did we say Subdivision 5 was under this jurisdiction? It extends the existing exception, meaning no penalty, to purchases of electronic delivery devices made by a youth who is directly supervised by an adult for training, education, research, or enforcement purposes.
So compliance checks.
Yes. Subdivision 5 extends existing exception to purchases of electronic delivery made by a youth, not for compliance.
Well, if law enforcement is using an underage person to do a compliance check to go in,
correct,
to purchase one of these products,
yes,
this exempts that youth from being subject to penalties.
That's correct. Okay. I'm sorry, I misunderstood. You're talking about compliance checks that will be under the responsibility of local government.
Okay. And then Section 7?
It really modifies to state that the penalty does not apply in Subdivision 1, 2, and 3 to electronic delivery services.
And then if we go back to Section 3, Subdivisions 2 through 6.
In Subdivision 3, which is the statutes for municipal licensing of tobacco and similar products, Subdivision 2 applies to the existing administrative penalties to retail license holders and employees who sell electronic delivery devices or e-cigarettes or nicotine or Lobelia delivery products to anyone under the age of 18. So that's adding that language to as it relates to those under the age of 18. Subdivision 3 applies the existing administrative penalties to individuals who sell electronic delivery services, etc., to those under 18. Subdivision 4 requires a local licensing authority to consult with educators and parents and children and the court system to develop alternative penalties for children or youth under the age of 18 who purchase, possess, or consume these through the use of these electronic delivery services. Subdivision 5 requires the local licensing authorities to conduct the unannounced compliance checks that we do for tobacco. So it applies that same concept for municipalities to this product, these products. And Subdivision 6, the existing affirmative defense exists to the charge of making a sale of tobacco to persons under the tobacco or this product. It just adds this product to that language of affirmative defense for those who sell in good faith to persons under the age of 18.
And Senator Sharon, some of these apply to Lobelia or Lobelia delivery products. What is Lobelia?
I haven't got the
maybe one of your testifiers
slightest idea, but maybe somebody here does.
Why don't we go on? Come on forward, Janelle Waldock.
I can answer it very quickly. Janelle Waldock from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, Lobelia is an herb that has some nicotine properties within it.
All right. Thank you. Senator Sharon, should we go into your testifiers now?
That would be great. I'd appreciate it. I'd like to begin with Dr. Mark Dean from North Mankato, who has to leave within a very short period of time. So he's requested that he be the first of our testifiers.
Thank you. Welcome, Dr. Dean.
Afternoon. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm a doctor of chiropractic in North Mankato. I am also the mayor of the city of North Mankato. And so I'm actually here under both guises today. As a bit of historical perspective, the city of North Mankato passed a smoking ban on all of our establishments and public places within the city of North Mankato in 2005, well before the state legislature passed that similar legislation on the state level. So at the same time, the city of Mankato, our sister city across the river, had not. And that created a bit of a divisive circumstance between our two cities. And I'd like to speak to the e-cigarette circumstance today because that's, again, raised its head in our community. The city of Mankato did pass their no smoking of electronic devices, no use of electronic devices in public places in January of this year. The city of North Mankato has had two public hearings to that effect thus far. The first, at that time, we put in August of last year, we put a moratorium on e-cigarette use in our city until we could study this and see where the ramifications were. In February of 18th of this last month, we again took it up, looked at some sample ordinances, and have decided to wait the state legislature, your actions, before we make a decision on where to go forward. But we have directed our staff that if the state legislature does not take an action in this session, that we will then use the Clean Indoor Air Act to utilize that in our city and bring that forward for our consideration. I've come to you with my other hats as well. I'm a lifetime asthmatic, so I'm sensitive to indoor air and the cleanness of it. I'm a chemistry major, so I'm concerned about the products and the mixing of them without supervision with something as toxic as nicotine. I also am concerned about, from my healthcare profession, about the effects of nicotine use on my patients, as I've witnessed that over the years. And while the claim was made that cigarettes were unknown at the time they were passed. We are certainly aware of nicotine's effects today, and so it would be naive of us to think that this kind of delivery system is going to have any other effect. I'm a past national chair of the Council of Chiropractic Guidelines and Practice Parameters, and I've been published in scientific literature, so I'm well aware of what the science can and cannot state. And while there is absence of evidence right now on the deleterious effects long-term of e-cigarettes on users, that does not equate to absence of evidence of absence long-term. And so I also have two teenage children, and I'm gravely concerned about the marketing efforts that are being done in our city already. And the fact that during the public hearings that we did have, we had e-cigarette users come up and testify that they enjoyed Skittles and Mountain Dew flavor and bubblegum flavor and cotton candy flavors, when I think that's really an anecdotal evidence that the cigarette companies are looking at marketing to a younger generation. Finally, as my role as mayor and as an elected official like yourselves, I'm concerned and I'm a strong supporter of personal liberties and the fact that people have the right to make their own choices, certainly within their own property, as long as they do not negatively impact their neighbors. However, that also comes with personal responsibility. And the evidence is strong that these kinds of usages have choices that affect all of us because they raise our health care premiums, and all of us, the state being the largest health care insurer purchaser, it's going to raise the premiums of all of our users, all of our taxpayers as they fund that. So I would urge you to consider using this, regulating this new technology under the Clean Indoor Air Act, and to do so at the statewide level rather than forcing individual municipalities like my own to go through the process of creating legislation that may be duplicative or conflicting with other communities. And so with that, I urge you to follow through with the Clean Indoor Air Act as it's been proposed by Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Dr. Dean. Any questions? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, you were talking about the effect of nicotine. I understand the effect of the smoke on lungs, but what's the effect of nicotine?
Nicotine is the seventh most toxic substance, Senator, in the top 10 list of toxic substances available in the world currently. A dropper full will kill a plant. A slightly larger amount can have toxic effects on the human body and lead to death if it's administered incorrectly. And so the fact that these e-cigarette shops can create sampling and they can mix their own, so to speak, and put in as much nicotine as the purchaser might want in the effort to using it as smoking cessation. If that's misapplied or done so inappropriately, it could have quite serious deleterious effects on the individual and certainly on those that are involved. And there is no, the other point I might add is when you look at the packaging, there are no labels on those packages. There's no safety cap on those packages. If it would be in the hands of a child or a spill would occur and a pet would pick it up, there is certainly life-threatening consequences in those smaller individuals.
Follow up?
Senator
Hall. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is there a nicotine effect to those that are around the person smoking, or is it just to the person smoking?
I think that's still, Senator, thank you for the question. I think that's still to be determined. The evidence is somewhat conflicted at this point on that. However, I am aware of a case in Minnesota where there was an arrest of an individual with an e-cigarette delivery device that had inserted methamphetamine. And most of you know that methamphetamine is extremely toxic and extremely addictive, even in very small doses. And so the secondhand user at that point would certainly be subject to some significant consequences. Now, that's an extreme example and probably an uncommon example, but it shows the potential and the challenges that these delivery devices are going to create for all of us.
Senator Hall.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, the effect of nicotine on somebody else that's not using, there isn't any, unless it's something else, another chemical that might be put in there.
Again, Senator,
Dr. Dean.
I appreciate that. The The question is, that has not yet been defined in the science, and it is early in the science to decide that. The literature talks about, you know, depends on proximity and dose, air conditions, lots of things that are there. It has not been well defined at this point. Again, we know the effects of nicotine, and so it can be, you can make some suppositions, but at this point the literature does not definitively define that, and so I can't give you a stronger answer than that at this time.
Okay.
Senator Hall, I think part of the uncertainty is that we don't know what else is being mixed either into it. So whatever vapor is released, we just have no idea what that vapor contains. It could be quite harmful or toxic. It could be not at all, but we just don't know. And I think part of the idea is until that science gets fleshed out or until there's some regulations as to what can or could not be mixed in, there's a risk borne by, secondhand risk borne by others in the room when vaping occurs. I think that's part of the theory here anyway.
But Mr. Chair, taking, for instance, paint, we wouldn't want to say you can't use a paint can because somebody might put lead paint in there. Somebody can do anything, you know, in a different container, but we wouldn't want to stop that from being used in a proper method and having paint that didn't have lead in it. You know what I'm saying? I'm not sure I can.
Senator Letts,
I can go that far.
Senator Sherman.
I'd like to respond to that, but then you might want to have the other testifiers come forward.
Yes.
And, you know, I want to remind everybody we're not prohibiting the use of paint, nor are we prohibiting the use of e-cigarettes or the other products defined. We are affirming the right of those who want to take that risk if they are adults, to use the product. What we're asking for is that they use alternatives if they're in interior rooms where they're sharing space with others, and that until we have clear evidence, as that has to start with the direction that the FDA has been given, which is to begin to regulate what goes in these cartridges. So you can't even begin to really rely on any research until everything that's being studied has commonality to it. There's variations on these themes of. And we can't really have a measurement of what the impact of all of those different kinds of cartridges are. But what we're asking for you, until we're better at that, until the FDA completes its work in trying to regulate what's in the cartridge, what has to be on the label, have some time for us to measure what it does in terms of vapor, that yet not ask the public to take the risk, along with those who choose to take in through electronic devices, the substances that are placed in these cartridges. So that's what this bill is about. It's not to prohibit it. In the same way that we don't prohibit people from painting their walls, we do make recommendations to not come in the room for a while afterwards, but we don't prohibit the paint. So I know there are people here to testify and that you have a time frame here, so I just wanted to give the interaction between us to follow maybe the testifiers who've come to present.
Thank you. Senator Sherman, why don't you call your next testifier?
Our next testifier is Jim Koppel here, or was there an alternative, somebody alternatively here from the, oh, Jim is here, okay. Jim Koppel is here. He's the, for those of you who don't know, I'd be surprised, but he's the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Department of Health.
Welcome, Mr. Koppel.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Koppel, Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Health. I'll be brief in talking about the bill and from the enforcement angles. One, we support the bill in its entirety, but specifically to sections 3 and 6. The conformity of existing law to the proposed is very consistent. We have, under current law, a great deal of conformity in a relatively short period of time that Clean Indoor Air Act and cigarette smoke has been prohibited in a growing number of areas. We have somewhere between 30 and 50 complaints filed a year. We find that many of things are taken care of at places of business, you know, without additional enforcement. The rule itself is well followed, and we feel that the addition of e-cigarettes is consistent not only in the behavior patterns that would be followed, but also consistent in terms of applying the same sanctions and penalties. So we don't see any problems in the this additional statute.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Koppel? Thank you, sir. Senator Sharon, who do you wish to call next? Do we have Ms. Waldock, who's appeared to your right, Senator Sharon?
Well, I'm sorry, I just got handed some data here that's astounding in terms of the reported toxic exposures reported for e-cigarettes and tobacco products in Minnesota. So I'm sorry, I was stunned by the number of reported toxic exposures to e-cigarettes. So I'm sorry, I will offer the opportunity for you to introduce yourself and while I recover.
No problem. I'd be happy to. I have the same shocking data, and I can cover it. So, Mr. Chair, Janelle Waldock, I'm the director of the Center for Prevention at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota. Out of respect for the narrow jurisdiction that this committee has over the bill and your short time frame, I'm going to keep my comments short and simple, but I do want to focus on the high level. I want you to know about the high level of support that exists for this bill. So I'm here speaking on behalf of a broad coalition of health organizations that include the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, the Association for Non-Smokers Minnesota, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, Clearway Minnesota, the Minnesota Medical Association, and many others. I'm also a veteran of the fight that happened to pass the Clean Indoor or the Freedom to Breathe Act in 2007, and many of you, certainly Senator Sharon, are the ones that really made that large policy success happen. It can be hard to remember sometimes the controversy that surrounded that law or how it took years to pass. The reason it's so hard to remember today is because the Freedom to Breathe Act is one of the most popular policies that our state has ever seen. In fact, every survey conducted since 2007 has found it growing even more popular, with the most recent poll conducted just in January showing that 87% of Minnesotans approve of that law. That's a very strong nod of support from Minnesotans throughout the state. In addition to that high level of support for the existing law, Minnesotans also overwhelmingly agree that e-cigarettes should be included in the law's language. In that same poll conducted in January, 79% of Minnesotans said that they support prohibiting e-cigarette use in places where smoke is already prohibited. An even larger number, 87%, support keeping e-cigarettes behind the counter, which is another provision in the bill that is in front of you today. The legislature can correct this loophole by taking a common sense approach. Support the legislation that is in front of you today. Our state has enjoyed clean indoor air for 7 years, and Minnesotans have responded. This is what they want. So let's not go backwards. I am going to take just 1 minute. This is hot off the press new data that the Minnesota Department of Health put together showing the level of toxic exposures reported for e-cigarettes over the last 3 years. And so it's data from the Hennepin Regional Poison Control Center that showed that in terms of kind of the exposures reported, it went from 5 in 2011 to 8 in 2012 to 74 in 2013. So I think you can see why Senator Sharon's jaw was dropping as she was digesting that. And so clearly this is these are products that we need to look at seriously and take action to start limiting the use of.
Is this polling information?
So the polling information just went around.
Yeah,
so.
Senator Sharon, the members of the committee have received the polling information.
Thank you.
We have not received that poison control data. So if there are copies available, we can make them available to the committee as well. Thank
Is
you,
there
Ms.
a page
Walda.
That can help us?
Yeah. Does Pat McCone wish to offer any testimony as well?
Yes, and thank you, Senator Latz and committee. Pat McCone, I'm the Director of Tobacco Control Programs and Policy for the American Lung Association. I'm based out of Duluth and drove here this morning. The roads are fine. And I do want to take that time from the road to just say a few things relevant to this committee and relevant to us as parents and as grandparents and as brothers and sisters and all the rest that goes with this is about taking care of each other. I have worked, and again, on policy around tobacco use and now e-cigarette use for several years. And in relationship to the fight on freedom to breathe, we heard the same argument that we've heard in other committee hearings, that how are you going to enforce this? That came up to us in 2007 with freedom to breathe. Are we going to have the smoking police and just all that imaginary issues that came with it? And the truth is that freedom to breathe has gone very well. That's already been testified. I also want to say I worked on this issue in North Dakota, where North Dakota, a very conservative state, voted as a vote of the people that included limiting e-cigarettes indoors in every single district by 66% or more in support of regulating clean air indoors. For those of you who don't know or haven't seen the marketing on e-cigarettes, you know, there are a variety of them. I only have a couple along, but one you may think of like this that looks just like a cigarette. This is some of the concern at the local level. How do you enforce a clean indoor air policy when someone's puffing on one of these that looks exactly like a cigarette? But as a grandma and a mother, this one really got me. It's a Hello Kitty e-cigarette. Now, how do I explain that to my grandchildren? Well, that's Hello Kitty, and it's got toxic chemicals in it that you shouldn't use. But Grandma, they might say, it smells like lemon, blueberry, cotton candy. Well, that's because that's the flavor that they sell in this drug delivery system. We do not want a deadly, addictive drug renormalized in our state. And I want to say it wasn't us who talked about e-cigarettes first. It were the company themselves. And I brought you some of those ads. Smoke anytime, almost anywhere. The green smoke, the e-cigarette, truly is the social cigarette. You can smoke in restaurants and cafes, bars and nightclubs, offices and shopping centers, and malls. The e-cigarette ad, well, I'm just going to show you who their spokesperson are, because I know our time is limited, but I drove 5 hours, so I'm going to take 2 more minutes.
Ms. McCone, take a few minutes, but we have others came for other bills that would rather not come back tomorrow.
All right, so this is freedom to smoke anywhere you want. For all smokers, we're introducing them to the new generation of smoking. I would remind you that Blue cigarettes are owned by Lorillard Tobacco. Are we going to put the health of our children in the themes of the tobacco industry, convicted racketeers? I hope not. And I hope this isn't offensive, but maybe it's meant to be. This is what Blue cigarettes think about our smoke-free policies. They want their toxic chemicals to come back into our air and renormalize putting up a nicotine delivery device to your lips. Because my grandchildren have never seen this in public. And I don't want them to see this in public. So I strongly urge you to support this bill. People love our smoke-free policy. We're law-abiding citizens. It will be obeyed and will be supported. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McCone. Any discussion on the bill itself? Seeing none.
Do you have more testifiers, Senator?
As far as I'm aware, there are no other. Oh, I'm sorry. My mistake. Cap O'Rourke also asked to testify on this. Cap, why don't you come on forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Welcome, I will be brief, and I will try to stick as close to the points that are under this committee's jurisdiction as possible.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Cap O'Rourke, and I am representing the Independent Vaping Retailers Association of Minnesota. This is a coalition of small businessmen and women owners who have their shops, distribution centers, and manufacturing centers based in Minnesota, and they deal in vaping products, solutions, and paraphernalia. My shops largely support all the provisions that this committee is looking after, the penalties, the limiting the sale of these products to underage people. We already do that. All of our retail shops have a policy of not allowing people under the age of 30, or carding everyone under the age of 30, and not allowing minors into the shop unless escorted by a parent or guardian. The one concern we have, and this might be a technical concern, and I left my copy of the bill, but in the definition of electronic delivery device, it lists all products or parts, regardless if they're marketed or if they're sold separately. One thing to take into account is there are batteries that are used in some of these products that may not be specific to these products. So, and it doesn't say exclusively used in this product. So if there's a battery that you use to charge one of these items, and if a battery store sells one of those batteries to someone who's 16 who's using it for a different device, I think in reading this that they will be in violation of this. And I think that's not the author's intention, so I'm just kind of raising that as a potential point. Yeah, that's but it says here whether or not marketed or sold separately. So if you sell the battery separately to someone under the age of 18, you may be in violation.
Can you point out the provision us, please?
It's on page 5. It's under subdivision 1, definitions, and it's subdivision 1, part C on page 5. And CAP is referencing line 5.15. Whether or not marked or sold separately.
5.18.
Oh, excuse me, 5.18. Thank you.
And so it's just something to consider.
So if we were to, after any component part of a product, insert something to the effect of except batteries?
I think in talking to my retail shops, I think batteries are probably the most obvious thing. They're kind of evolving, but I haven't seen too many other parts that you would use differently.
Senator Sharon?
What I would like to offer, based on this particular issue anyway, we have two more committees. We have Commerce, for example. It would be a great place for us to have a chance to maybe make an amendment if we can get some language from the industry as to what it is they feel they need to do, as long as it doesn't undermine the intent of the bill. I'd be willing to work to get that put together. I think CAP would have to get that language to describe what it is that you're needing, and we can move it. We can get that put in the right form and address that in the Commerce if that's agreeable to everybody. Okay.
Senator Sharon, I'm on Commerce also, so I can certainly keep an eye on that. And Mr. O'Rourke, maybe you want to check with your clients and see if there's anything in addition to batteries that you want to make sure are included in that as well.
I will say, just for the record, while my organization, my clients, have no problems with the issues that have been raised in this committee, as a whole, we do oppose this bill specifically for the issue of Section 1 of including it in the Clean Indoor Air Act, primarily based that there's not been any scientific evidence to this point saying that the byproducts of this are harmful to those around this product. And I just as a quick aside, it should also be noted that despite the numerous concerns raised about the contents of these products or the lack of labeling, there is nothing in this bill that addresses any of those concerns. So if you are worried about enhanced nicotine levels or all the dangerous chemicals that could be mixed in wherever, they can still be mixed wherever, although all my clients have clean rooms where they do that. But my clients do label the ingredients that are in their product, but there's nothing in this bill that requires them to do that. They just do that to assuage their own customers. So,
thank you. Well, Mr. O'Rourke, we'll let Commerce address Section 1, and we'll focus in on our enforcement provisions. Appreciate your focus and your testimony on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll ask the room. Is there any? Senator Hall, you had a question?
I have a few, but on that point, if it's all the parts of that cigarette, would the flavors or some of those just flavoring, would they be subject to the same kind of controls, or, you know what I'm saying, besides battery? If you've got different flavorings, if you can't use them there, you can't use them other places. I think we need to look at that. So I think that's good. But if I could go on to a couple things. First off, in Section 2 at 1.13, which I'm not sure I want to do much except ask questions about, it talks about this applying to schools, and it prohibits it from facilities and vehicles that are owned. Is it your understanding that, because that really doesn't change, is it your understanding that someone can smoke while they're at a football game on the field of a of the field owned by the property? It's not a property issue here. It's a facility that I understand it. So a teacher could walk outside and light up a cigarette on the property as long as they're not inside the building. Am I correct on that? Does anybody know?
Are you talking a regular cigarette?
I'm talking a regular cigarette.
No. Most school districts have policies that are grounds and buildings, anything they own.
Okay, so they have that, but we don't have that as a state. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. That was one. Second, Section 6.16. Can you, this is on exemptions, and the penalties do not apply to persons under the age of 18 who purchase or attempts to purchase tobacco or tobacco-related products, now adding electronic delivery devices, while under the supervision of a responsible adult for training, education, research, and enforcement. Now, I understand enforcement because you may be doing a sting, but when would an adult, for training purposes, ask a minor, or for education purposes, or for research purposes, a responsible adult ask a minor to go in and buy cigarettes for him? Any thought on that?
Ms. McCall.
Chair, I've conducted a lot of what are called compliance checks, and there are times for those youth that you go out and you train. They go in and you observe, or their peers observe, how they're making the ask or the buy, that they're following the guidelines, and so that would be a training purchase. You're not actually doing, or it could be that we're working with law enforcement and they're training the kids to go out and actually then do the compliance checks. And those are the enforcement purposes.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Could not a parent that didn't want to buy for their kid just say, hey, go in and get it. If they ask me, I'll say it's for some kind of training purposes. I'm training you on how to do something.
Senator, the parent could not have the child go in and purchase for themselves. They'd have to go in and purchase it and then give it to the child. But there is a provision in here about an individual purchasing for a child as well.
Okay. And my last question, Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall, last question.
I am a father, and I've got 8 children. I've got 9 grandchildren. I actually hate smoking. I hate the concept of it. But I think Section 1 goes too far, especially with no scientific evidence. You can say there may be. Well, I that's a very weak argument to me. And so I would like to give an oral amendment to remove Section 1 of this bill.
I suppose it's in order, even. It's jurisdiction. All right, Senator Hall has moved to delete Section 1 of the bill. Any further discussion? Senator Sharon?
I would encourage the committee to oppose this. It cuts out a significant and important part of the bill. It complements the sections for protecting children, not just from the sale, but from exposure as well as observation of smoking. So if you're concerned about the second sections related to the 18 persons under age 18, you ought to be concerned about the first section. And in addition, this doesn't go too far. It really asks the persons who are vaping, I think is the term, to have the right to continue to do that, but to respect that until we're clearer about what it is that is being exhaled, that they not ask the public to take the risk with them. until we're fairly certain that that risk is within reason.
Any further discussion on Senator Hall's proposed amendment? Senator Hall has moved to delete Section 1 of the bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail. Any further discussion on Senate File 2027?
I'd be happy to move Senate File 2027. Pass and be referred to local government, state and local government.
All those in favor of Senator Sharon's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. We have about 3 minutes. We're going to try to take up We will take up Senate File 2108 at this time, sales representative agreement. And I'm sorry for those who came for the indemnity agreements. We'll have to take that up at tomorrow's meeting at noon.
Okay, Senator Letts, Senate File 1757, and I understand you have an author's amendment.
I do, Madam Chair. The A1 amendment is the author's amendment. This is the first stop for this bill. I ask for your support.
Senator Letts, are you doing 2108, your second bill? Okay, I apologize. Senate File 2108, and there is also an author's amendment on this.
Move the A1 amendment.
Okay. Senator Letts.
Chair, I move the A1 amendment.
Okay. Senator Letts moves the A1 amendment. Would you like to explain it? Or you want to do that as part of the bill?
On page 1, line 16, before the first or, insert renewed, so that, Chair, this bill will apply to new and renewed contracts.
Okay, any questions, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you. Madam Chair, this bill addresses a situation dealing with contracts for sales representatives, particularly having to do with what states' laws those contracts will be interpreted under and enforced. Presently, out-of-state employers who have sales representatives in Minnesota can't have as a provision in their sales representative's contract that any disputes that arise under that contract be handled under the laws of the state of the company or any state that they choose. They could say California, if that's where the company's based, or New Jersey, and that would leave a Minnesota-based employee, sales representative, perhaps trying to enforce a contract in a state that's far away from them and as a practical matter inaccessible to them. So this bill removes that impediment to enforcement and would allow a Minnesota-based sales representative to enforce the law in Minnesota. In fact, what it would do is it would prohibit states from or companies from putting provisions of this nature into their sales representatives' contracts. So I would ask Gene Hoff, who's an attorney with Minko and Hoff, available to answer questions relating to this bill. And I have Michelle, is it Tepke, Jobst, who's here, president of Jobst Incorporated. Perhaps she can give us some brief information on the bill and its impact.
Okay, Ms. Tepke.
Madam Chairman. My name is Michelle Tepke Jobst, and I'm the owner of a small second-generation family business. Many manufacturers' representatives are individuals, and all of them are small businesses. My father started our manufacturer's rep agency back in 1978, and I'm here today to support this bill because as a manufacturer's representative, my job is to promote the sales of products and services for the principals that I contract with. And I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a politician, and my concern is when I sign a contract with a non-Minnesota manufacturer, and I do really well for them, at this time they currently have the choice not to honor the contract. And this is a loophole that Minnesota principals do not have. Small businesses like me, we need simple, uniform laws to make it easier to understand the risks we're taking when we sign a contract. And opportunistic terminations, where a principal terminates contracts to avoid having to pay me for what I already earned, takes away my right as the sales rep to recoup costs of doing business over many months and many years with building a relationship with a customer to bring in a sale for a principal, and they get to keep that business. The value of the manufacturer's rep to the principal is those long-term relationships with the customers. And our small size as manufacturer's reps makes us cost-effective for the principals. And right now, Minnesota sales reps are currently exposed to great risk when we contract with out-of-state principals who might be looking for free labor versus a cost-effective partner.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Ms. Topke? No questions? Thank you. This is Mr. Hoff. Did you have any comments?
Madam Chair, Gene Hoff. I'm an attorney that represents Minnesota manufacturers reps. In general, it's just fairness. It applies to Minnesota businesses. There's a loophole that needs to be dealt with, and that's providing a remedy under Minnesota law for Minnesota reps if they're contracting without state manufacturers. And I've represented a lot of them. And unfortunately, the law as written, when you have a waiver, it takes all rights away from Minnesota sales reps. Most states are parochial. So if you have a California manufacturer that says the contract's subject to California law, the rep's not going to have any protection because California's law, for an example, only pertains to a California sales representative or California territory. It's a great amendment.
Okay. Anybody else want to testify for or against? Well, it looks like we have a vote.
So, Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Lath.
I move that Senate file
1757-2108,
as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor.
Senator Lath, it says move to Commerce.
Oh, we have to go to Commerce, then that's my motion.
Okay. Commerce must have asked for it. Okay, Senate File 2108 is recommended to pass and sent to Commerce. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And then for you, did you want to go back to your other bill or not?
No, Madam Chair, since we're past our scheduled committee time, we'll take up 1757 tomorrow. I think we'll try to take that up first out of respect to those who waited here through today.
Okay.
So that'll be at noon tomorrow.
Okay, yes, those are the announcements. We'll be meeting tomorrow, Friday, March 7th at noon here in room 15. Next week, we will be meeting during our regular time on Tuesday and Thursday at noon. We will also meet on Tuesday, March 13th at 6 p.m. and Friday. Tuesday and Thursday?
No, just Thursday.
Tuesday is a typo, Madam
Chair.
Oh, Thursday,
sorry. Okay.
13.
You guys don't usually make any mistakes. We will also meet Thursday, March 13th at 6 p.m. and Friday, March 14th at noon. And that meeting is adjourned.